Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. Where is the line between appropriate government action when it comes to the surveillance of its citizens? How much privacy do we have against the government's use of surveillance technologies, ranging from simple microphones to wiretaps to thermal imagers to drones and beyond? These are questions many judges have had to grapple with over the last half century. These are also questions today's guest, Cyrus Farivar, explores in his new book, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. Cyrus Farivar is senior business editor at Ars Technica and author of The Internet of Elsewhere. He's a radio producer and has reported for NPR, PRI, and others. His latest book is Habeas Data, and he joins us in studio. Hi, Cyrus. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Such an interesting book. Before we dive in and talk about these issues and how they're covered, as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention?
Sure. So something that literally kept me up late last night was a piece in the New York Times by Jennifer Valentino DeVries. This was a piece in the Times looking at a subject near and dear to my heart, which is government surveillance. And this story was about a company called Securus, because all these security and surveillance companies have really fun, ominous sounding names. But so it turns out that this company basically, I guess, is able to access phone location data for the government. Securus is a company that provides telephone services to prisons, and also they're able to relatively easily locate any phone in the country simply with just a cell phone number. And they do this by certifying that they have the proper, or by essentially checking a box saying that they have, you know, authorization for it, when in fact they don't in many cases. And there was an employee who's now facing federal charges for abusing this authority. But what this case has highlighted is how easy it has gotten to get, things like our location data. This is even more of a it's sort of related to a Supreme Court case that we're waiting to hear what the Supreme Court's ruling on, a case called Carpenter about, under what authority do police need to obtain, in that particular case, Carpenter, over 128 days worth of somebody's cell site location information records, right, where somebody was.
And this piece specifically, can you be more specific about the companies that are involved in this?
Sure, yeah. So the way this particular this story works, or the way that this company works, is as I understand, and I'd never heard of this company before, and it's so hard to follow, to keep really close track. I do this for a living, and I still feel like I'm always behind because there are so many of these companies. According to this story, this company, Securus, is basically getting its data from companies, data brokers that provide mobile data, usually for the purposes of advertising, usually for the purposes of thing. You've seen, you get a text message from a company that you want to do business with, Carl's Jr. or some, ice cream shop or whatever, and you say, yes, I would like to get, special coupons from, let's say, Carl's Jr. When I'm near one, right? And I allow them to text me to do that, right? Some people might do that. So this company, Securus, is getting data from companies like that provide these types of services. That's where they're getting it from. And originally it goes back to the telcos. But it seems like it's being kind of unregulated and it's being used in ways that aren't fully anticipated.
Well, you just said that you can't keep up, and it's hard to keep up with much of anything these days because there's so many things going on every single day. But when you look specifically at this issue, technology, privacy, surveillance, all of these new ways to gather evidence about people. What are your thoughts about the overall reporting? Do you think it's good in places like the New York Times, or do you have to go to somewhere like Wired or Ars Technica, and I'd love for you to tell us more about that later, to really get the details?
I mean, I think, different audiences, different websites, different media outlets have different audiences, right? So the website I work for, Ars Technica, we tend to have much more tech-savvy readers. We try to write for a general audience, but we also know that a lot of people who read our site, we've been around for 20 years, a lot of our audience, you know, are people who have a background in IT. And so we try as much as we can to really dig into the specific, you know, tech details of things. But also at the same time, you know, we want anybody to be able to read and understand it. Whereas something like the New York Times, they're writing, of course, for a much broader audience. And in fact, that article that I was reading last night, it took me a couple times to read it and then consulting with other people in the field to fully understand what exactly it was saying, because it didn't, and I don't fault the reporter for this at all, I think that that's just the audience that they're writing for. It wasn't immediately obvious to me precisely what technique was being used to acquire this location data. So, you know, as somebody who wants to know those kinds of details, and I understand why maybe she chose to leave them out, you know, I just wanted a little bit more. So, you know, I think all of us, whether it's Wired, whether it's Ars Technica, whether it's the New York Times, there's lots of websites, there's lots of us out here that are trying to figure these things out. You know, we could use more. We could always use more help. I think all of us are feeling really inundated right now.
You began as a professional reporter in 2004. You write that you were dazzled by the technology, like so many people are when they first use it, right? You write that a half century ago, the Supreme Court ruled that if someone steps into a phone booth and closes the door, we have a reasonable expectation of privacy. It's a great visual, much in the same way that we do at home. In most cases, the government needs a warrant first. But since that time, as technology has advanced incredibly quickly, the government has understandably adopted tools to its advantage.
Right. And so it's amazing to me, yeah, when I first started off, I don't think I had the sophistication as a young reporter. Maybe I'm hopefully slightly more sophisticated now. But, you know, when I first started off as a tech reporter, I imagined that I would be writing about new technologies. And I was generally pretty excited about them, you know. And I don't think, you know, I definitely didn't have the thoughtfulness that I try to have now about thinking about, well, what does it mean when, you know, you have, you know, a database that can access people's, you know, phone location. What does it mean when police have a tool, and I write about this in the book, right, when you have a tool called a license plate reader that can capture license plates at incredible speeds, up to 60 plates per second, far faster than any human or far faster than any team of humans could possibly capture, you know? And that technology is totally legal right now. So I didn't have the good understanding of really sitting down and taking a step back and saying, okay, well, what does it mean now that this thing exists?
Talk a little bit about the license plate readers, because you've reported
on that. I
can
talk about license plate readers forever.
Yeah, you reported on that for a while now.
I have.
And it's close to where we are right now in Oakland.
Yeah.
That's when you first wrote about
it. Yeah. So, you know, 5-6 years ago, I started writing about license plate readers. And it's actually a good example, because when I was a younger reporter, if you go back and you look through Wired.com, Wired News' archives, you'll find, and you search for my name and you search for license plate readers, you'll find a story I did about the testing of license plate readers in Los Angeles County. Specifically, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department was testing the use of license plate readers. And I spoke with this one L.A. Sheriff's commander, a guy by the name of Sid Hale, and this was his job, was to evaluate new technology for the Sheriff's Department. And he was super excited, and he was saying, hey, look, you know, we can capture stolen cars, we can go after these bad guys, and that's awesome. And, you know, and if you go and you read the story I wrote, it takes generally that tone that, like, isn't this great, basically? And again, I didn't really think about, well, what does it mean when this isn't just being tested in one little place on one little car, when this is pervasive as it is now, right? So I live in Oakland. Right now, more than 30 Oakland police cars have license plate readers mounted on them. They're in many, many, many cities in America, big and small, counties, big and small, all over the country. And so now we have a system where, in many cases, police are amassing large quantities of data, right? They're capturing people's plates and they're connecting that to a date and a time and a location. And they're keeping that information for months or years or sometimes indefinitely.
In July 2013, you filed a number of public records requests with law enforcement agencies across the state of California asking for records about your own car over the previous year. What did you learn?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. So public records request is one of those tools that journalists like you and I, right, we try to use as much as we can. But I want to remind people that public records are things that anybody can do, right? You don't have to be a journalist. You don't have to be a lawyer. It's not hard. Oftentimes, it's as easy as sending an email to the police or to any other public agency. So literally anybody could do this. Literally anybody could ask their own police department, a city in California or whatever state you live in, for your own records, and the police are obliged to give it to you, hopefully they are. So I filed records requests in the city where I live in Oakland. I asked San Francisco, San Mateo County, Alameda County, the city of Piedmont, the city of Berkeley, my hometown of Santa Monica, California, the LAPD, the LA Sheriffs, the California Highway Patrol, a few, basically places that I would conceivably go, right, in a given year. And they came back, and some of them said, we don't have any records. Santa Monica, I'm in Santa Monica 4 or 5 times a year. They said they only had one record. The city of Piedmont, just a tiny city that's surrounded physically by Oakland, refused to give me records. The city of Oakland, however, Piedmont refused to give me records. Oakland came back with 15 or 20 records of my car, and that had been scanned at different places around the city. And I was really surprised to see, it didn't reveal anything particular about me. It showed that, my car had been scanned outside of the apartment where I had been living very briefly. It showed me in different parts of town. But it started to give me a sense of like what this data actually looks like and what it means to have this captured. And then I did another article later on where I took that one step further. And instead of filing for records only about myself, I asked the city of Oakland through a records request to give me all of the license plate reader records that they had ever collected. And they did. And they gave me 4.6 million records. And that looks like 20 Excel spreadsheets with hundreds of thousands of lines each with unredacted plates, dates, times, and GPS locations. So this gave me a really creepy superpower. This gave me the ability to look up any plate that I saw on the streets of Oakland and figure out something about that person, right? And this record, this data, the city of Oakland has published. It's not only me that can get it. Literally anybody can get it right now. The city of Oakland has published it publicly online right now. So you could, build a tool and try to figure out, who's going where, and you could learn a lot about somebody.
You quoted Catherine Crump, a former ACLU lawyer and current professor at UC Berkeley. And in 2015, she told you, quote, "Where someone goes can reveal a great deal about how he chooses to live his life. Do they park regularly outside the Lighthouse Mosque during times of worship? They're probably Muslim. Can a car be found outside Beer Revolution a great number of times? Maybe a craft beer enthusiast, although possibly with a drinking problem."
That might be my car.
Especially when you're writing a book like this. But this is what's interesting about, because we've done a lot of shows about how, based on where you go online or where you're driving, the government can make assumptions about you.
Totally.
And that's where things can get ugly. It can
Absolutely.
Go down a path of, well, you've got examples.
Yeah, and I think it's important to, something that I think is a very natural instinct for people is to say, look, I'm a regular law-abiding citizen. I'm a regular taxpayer. I've never done anything wrong, right? I myself have never been arrested. As far as I know, I'm not being investigated by anybody. And yet, the city of Oakland and lots of other law enforcement agencies have records of my movement around town. And so you could imagine, right, there's lots of things that we all do that you might want the government to not have a record of, mm-hmm. right, where you worship. Do you go, to a gun store? Do you spend the night sometimes at places that are not your known residence? Do you go to a sex toy shop? Do you go to a strip club? Do you go to a gay bar? Do you go to city hall meetings? Do you go to a protest, right? There's all of those things are lawful and legal and normal, and we all do them. But, again, many of us, I think, would be very uncomfortable to know that there's a record of that.
Now, the license plate data is available online, but as you write, there's no way to know if those license plates have been captured by a privately owned license plate reader system.
Right. So what I've been talking about so far is government's ability to capture this data, right? So the Oakland Police's ability to capture it in San Francisco and other cities that employ this technology for their law enforcement agencies. Right here in the Bay Area, there's a company just down the way in Livermore, which is about an hour's drive east of Oakland, called Vigilant Solutions. And Vigilant Solutions claims to have the world's largest private license plate reader database. So I said, you know, when I asked for the records from Oakland, they came back with me for 4.6 million records. Vigilant claims to have 10 billion records nationwide.
Wow.
Yeah. And the way they do this is they sell these license plate reader kits to tow truck and repossession companies. And so these cars are driving, and tow trucks and stuff are driving around the country. Vigilant is creating its own database, and then it's selling access to that database to various law enforcement agencies. And again, you can imagine how this would be very, very useful, right? Lots of criminals aren't necessarily going to stay in one city or even one region, right? They may be, evading the law, running around. So you can understand, if you're a police investigator in Oakland and your suspect is fleeing to Nevada, why you might want, you know, data about that person from Nevada.
I've never heard of this company. How many private companies are there that do this kind of work?
Vigilant, as far as I know, is the largest one. It would not surprise me if there's a handful of smaller ones. I mean, it's important to realize that this technology is now so easy that, you know, it's conceivable. I know, for example, there are some folks that have built, there's a smaller company that's called OpenALPR, and they basically have essentially made their own. And so you could, if you wanted to, you could build your own. There's a free software that's available right now that you can download. Hmm. So you could set up, on your own street, on your own driveway, in your own neighborhood. You could make your own little, as the police call it, a hot list, right? So you could check to see if cars that you want or don't want are coming down your street.
Today we're joined by Cyrus Farivar, a senior business editor at Ars Technica and author of The Internet of Elsewhere. His latest book is Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. This is why we really need journalists to give us information about how we are being watched and to expose these companies that so many of us have never heard of. We have all these conversations about Facebook and Google and Twitter, and you name the big ones, but there's all these other ones that might be as, you know, billion-dollar companies, but we just haven't heard about them.
It's really true, and, you know, and it's very, it's hard because, you know, private companies generally, in my experience, are a lot less accountable than public entities. And yeah, we might be frustrated if the police reject my records request, but, you know, at least there's a process that I can apply for a records request, I can appeal it, I can sue them, right? A company like Vigilant Solutions that has all of these records, I can't file a public records request with them because they're a private company. They don't have to respond to me. I can't, you know, make them talk to me. There's much less public accountability with a private company. I wanted to interview Vigilant Solutions for the book, and they wouldn't talk to me. I have talked to them in the past for other articles, but I imagine they're not probably too pleased with me.
Well, if you have any questions or comments about privacy and how the media cover these issues, when we're talking about independent journalism, it's so important so we can learn about how we are being tracked and learn about the companies sometimes in our own backyard that we've never heard about. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Head over to KALW's Facebook page. Speaking of Facebook, click on the video there, and then you can leave a comment for all of Facebook to see. When you think about privacy today, in the post-9/11 era, when in the name of national security and safety, we can be watched and monitored really without us knowing, you cover 10 Supreme Court cases over the past 50 years, and you look at really how laws have redefined the parameters of what privacy means, given the incredible advancement of surveillance technology and how easily our personal information can be snatched without us knowing it. How do you think about privacy in today's world?
It's a good question. So it's important to kind of draw a distinction between, right, government surveillance, right, what the government is doing, whether it's through license plate readers, through drones, through body cameras, through anything else. And then privacy with respect to, you know, what private companies are able to do and do, right? So the in America, we tend to be, I feel like for the majority of us, our sort of default position is to be very skeptical of the government's activity, right? If you think about it, the entire American Revolution story is about fighting back against the powers of a foreign government entity, right? The King of England, right? We overthrew this monarch that arbitrarily exercised power over us. This is the story we tell ourselves. And if you look at the Constitution, right, the Constitution is about setting limits as to what the government cannot do. Congress shall make no law. These rights shall not be infringed, right? That's only talking about the government's activity, right? The Fourth Amendment has nothing to say about what Facebook can do or what Vigilant Solutions can do or what you and I can do against each other, right? That's a whole different thing. So when you talk about, I kind of draw that distinction. Mm. With privacy, you know, some people might feel, well, you know, privacy is dead. People share a lot of information. And that's true. But I think that for many of us, you know, even younger listeners, maybe, you know, I think we are starting to become a little bit more cognizant of how what we do online can be used against us and shared in ways that we don't fully anticipate.
We have a couple of emails. Michael writes in, I'm sorry, yeah, Mike in El Cerrito. Though a privacy amendment to the federal constitution failed decades ago, would it be possible for individual states relying on amendments 9 and 10 to amend their own constitutions to block some federal surveillance for the protection of privacy?
Well, this is where my legal knowledge may be wrong. I'm not a lawyer. I have been a very much an amateur student of the law. But it's important to remember that here in California, we do have an affirmative right to privacy. It's in Article 1, Section 1 of the California Constitution. California is only one of, I think, something like 10 states that has a specific affirmative right to privacy. The word privacy does not appear in the United States Constitution. It does not appear in our founding documents. The reasonable expectation of privacy is different than a right to privacy. I don't think under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution that a state would be able to say, you know, you feds can't surveil us with the, you know, through the NSA or other federal entities because the federal government has supremacy over us. But we can try. There are lots of agencies, you know, right now here in the Bay Area and in other places that are starting to realize that the technology that they employ, license plate readers in particular, that data can be shared with agencies like ICE for the purposes of deportation of undocumented people. So there's now, just very recently, within the last month, our city starting to wake up to this fact.
Well, thank you for the email. On the license plate readers, can you talk about how, where citizens have expressed outrage over this once they learn about it? Because that's what usually happens. And then cities taking action.
Yeah. So just very recently, in fact, I think it was just last week in Oakland, the city where I live, the Oakland City Council passed a new ordinance that for the first time established real meaningful community oversight over not just license plate readers, but over all technologies that would potentially impinge on people's privacy and would potentially be related to surveillance in some way. So now, if the police department, but any city agency, if they want to acquire, not just buy, because a lot of times this gear is acquired through federal grant money that cities don't have to pay for. So if a city agency wants to get license plate readers, drones, something super scary that we can't even imagine, right? Anything, they have to come before a privacy commission in Oakland, make a case for it. If it gets approved, then the agency has to come back every year and explain what they did, how many people they arrested, what effects it had, how they protected civil rights and civil liberties.
And as a journalist, are you able to get your hands on these federal grants? Because that's another way that we can stay informed about what's happening in our communities.
Yeah, yes, you can. They are public records. You can get them. So there's an entity here in the Bay Area that is the sort of federal arm. It's called UASI, the Urban Area Strategic Initiative or Security Initiative. I think their website is BayAreaUASI, UASI.org. They have regular meetings that you can go to. They're out in Dublin. And that is the entity where law enforcement agencies apply for these federal grants to get license plate readers and lots of other things.
Today we're joined by Cyrus Farivar about his new book, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, station manager here at KALW, inviting you to give your support for local public radio at 800-525-9917. You can also go online to kalw.org. I'm here in the studio with Lauren Schechter, who's on the Your Call team, inviting you to give your support.
Yes, you can donate at kalw.org or call us at 800-525-9917. Thank you. And if you donate $120, we will give you Cyrus Farivar's habeas data book as a thank you.
That's our way of saying we are here to give you information and ideas that are about the world around us. That, you know, it's like these changes are happening. We often aren't even aware. Your support lets us bring you the kind of journalism that Rose and her team at Your Call do every day. And that journalists that you hear on the Media Roundtable, folks like Cyrus Farivar, do. We give them a platform. Your support makes it possible.
Donate at kalw.org or call us at 800-525-9917. Thank you.
800-525-9917. Every contribution keeps this station strong. We appreciate having you involved. That's what makes it happen. One person at a time, supporting independent journalism like you hear from Rose and her guests.
Call 800-525-9917 or donate at kalw.org.
Thank you for those folks who are on the line now. We have habeas data, the new book by Cyrus Farivar, yours for a $120 contribution. That's $10 a month. Consider becoming a sustaining member of KALW, where you give ongoing monthly support. If you love Your Call, you love the Media Roundtable, now's the time to show your support. It feels good on a Friday morning, and we thank you for doing it.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by journalist Cyrus Farivar. He's senior business editor at Ars Technica and author of the new book, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. And he explores many questions in his book. Where is the line between appropriate government action when it comes to the surveillance of its citizens? And how much privacy do we have against the government's use of surveillance technologies? And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about how these issues are being covered? One of the ways that we find out how we are being watched is through journalism. And Cyrus talked about a piece in the New York Times. There's lots of tech publications that specifically focus on these issues. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can email your call at kalw.org. Or you can join us on Facebook, where we all share our personal information and our comments. Go over to the KALW Facebook page. I'm going to get to calls in a minute, but you talked about that example in Oakland. We are heard in other states around the country. So for people who heard your example about how citizens rose up, what are your thoughts about what lessons can be learned from that example?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that it's very important at the beginning to really better understand what technology is being used in your own backyard, right? I think a lot of people would be surprised to know how many license plate readers are currently deployed in your city. How many drones does your county sheriff have, right? So in my city, like I said, I happen to know that in Oakland we have over 30 license plate readers on the police cars. The county sheriff, I also happen to know, has 6 drones right now, the Alameda County Sheriff.
What do they do with the drones?
They use them for search and rescue. They use them as part of their law enforcement operations. There was the ghost ship fire in Oakland not too long ago that tragically killed a number of people. They used it as part of that investigation. They've used it. They've loaned out the drones to other agencies. I as far as I know, they're doing them for, you know, legitimate law enforcement purposes, but I think many of us, you know, wouldn't necessarily know if a county sheriff drone appeared over our house. But I would say the first step is to just understand what exists, right? If you don't know what technology exists in your community, file records requests or ask around to activism groups, lawyers, community organizers, people like the ACLU, entities like the Electronic Frontier Foundation here in San Francisco. There's lots of other local community groups. I know up in Seattle, there's a very active Seattle privacy community. Just find out what exists. And once you know, then you can say, with authority. Like, this is what exists. I'm uncomfortable with this. I want there to be clearer policies. I want to see what, you know, is being done in Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco. And I want to, you know, help my community take those ordinances, take those rules, and take them to my county supervisors, take them to my city council and say, hey, maybe we should adopt this. Maybe we should have a privacy commission in our city. Mm-hmm. I would love to see every city in America have a privacy commission. I would love to see every community in America have clear rules about how and where and under what circumstances these tools can be used. Because remember, these tools are useful. They do serve a purpose. Yeah. We want our police to enforce the law, but we also don't want them to infringe on our civil rights and our civil liberties.
Mm. Well, especially right now with what we're seeing with people of color and people calling the police for napping, Airbnb. I mean, these stories are just absolutely shocking.
It's true. It really is.
Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm part of the high-tech diaspora from the dot-com crash, and I've been in high-tech a long time, including playing with one of the first speech recognition systems on an Apple II. That sort of dates me how old that is. But anyway, I would agree with something the author said has said about the private sector. In a lot of ways, the biggest danger is from the private sector, and I would focus in on two things: the improvements in speech recognition, and also facial recognition. Mm-hmm. And you know, here's a hypothetical: let's say Facebook offers a Wi-Fi based peer-to-peer voice service like Skype for free, except you agree that Facebook will be able to have its computers in real time listen to your conversations and mine them for data that it can use to profile you and market you. And as I said, what we've got is in high tech, and this has been true since the 1940s when the first computers were built to calculate trajectories of artillery shells, and then the internet was built so DARPA could get better use of computers it was providing to university researchers, where government and private money are in this sort of hand. It's a, either you can call it a virtuous circle or a vicious circle or whatever, but anyway, there is a huge amount of money off of Sand Hill Road, the VC center in Menlo Park, that has been funding the AI big data approaches to voice recognition and facial recognition. And as I said, from what I understand, and Google had an announcement yesterday that caught a lot of people by surprise about an assistant that has almost no way to detect that it is not a computer speaking to you. It is. They gave some demos where it would call up a restaurant and make a reservation. And as I said, when you add all these together, the potential for Big Brother in the workplace and in the marketplace is something that I worry about way more than the government here. Mm-hmm. That's just me. But with respect to the government, it's also worth pointing out
thank you for the call. You brought up a lot of points there. Let's first talk about the voice recognition. And for those who didn't hear about this announcement, I'm just checking this out on CNN Tech. Google has moved to reassure the world that its new remarkably human-sounding voice assistant will not try to pass itself off as a person. It's called Google Duplex. And it was unveiled.
That's an amazing sentence that you just read, right? That an AI... is not going to be, it's not going to fool people. That's correct. Like, that's the world we live in right now, right? We now live in a world where there's a machine that has a voice where you and I, as normal human beings, cannot apparently distinguish between a machine and a human voice. That's crazy.
And so, what is this thing supposed to do?
I think the idea, and I haven't used it, as far as I know, Google has not made this available yet. They just showed like a few video examples. I don't think that they gave any like live examples. But as I understand it, it's meant to be, you know, like calling a restaurant. So you could type in a chat box or something, right? You know, call, you know, whatever your favorite pizzeria in your town, and the, you know, Google's voice would talk to a person and make that reservation for you, saving you, what, you know, a 5-minute phone call.
Or a 1 minute. So we can't even make our own reservations now. This piece says that the feature can help hearing impaired users or people who don't speak the local language.
Sure. And that, again, like lots of these technologies have real legitimate important uses. I think the what we don't want is that technology to be used for evil.
Right. To this question, and then we'll get to your other part, someone wrote in saying it's been established that smart speakers can be hacked and you can be spied on. Is that true?
Sure. Anything could be hacked. I mean, like no technology is bulletproof.
So he says, you know, NPR often urges us, tell your smart speaker to turn on NPR or KALW. And so that can be hacked. What could that be used for?
I mean, there was an article that I saw just, I think, this past week talking about, I think maybe again it was in the Times, saying that, you know, that the devices like the Alexa, for example, can hear at frequencies that far exceed what humans can hear at. So it would be very easy to, you know, imagine an evil person sitting outside your window with your Alexa in your bedroom playing a piece of audio that you wouldn't be able to hear, but your Alexa can hear, that would cause it to do something that you didn't want it to do.
Okay, and then if the Alexa, I'm not too familiar with how these work. So if you have an Alexa in your house and say, hey, turn on your call.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Cool.
That's innocuous.
Great.
But it's on all the time?
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, there are some police officers who think that I am dealing drugs, mm-hmm. and they want to find out if I'm talking about this.
Yeah.
Is there any possible way they could get access to that Alexa?
Yeah, so there was a case not dissimilar to what you just described in Arkansas from, I think it was last year, where there was somebody who was sadly murdered, and there was an Alexa present at the scene of the murder, and the police really wanted to get at the voice data that the Alexa captured, right? Because in order for these devices to work, they have to be recording all the time. They have to be listening all the time to know when you're going to be speaking to it. So, you know, and if you believe Amazon or these companies when they say that, you know, they capture only a short buffer and they delete, you know, after a certain period of time, that's great. It's impossible for you or I to really verify that that's true. And it depends sort of how much you trust a company like Amazon. Maybe you trust them a lot and great, you know. But you're right. We now, this is where this privacy rabbit hole never ends, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something more to be done, and there's always some new crazy scenario that unfolds.
And I'm sure you've heard these stories about people having conversations about something they want to buy. Like we were talking recently, maybe we should get a new mattress. And then a week later, all these coupons for mattresses showed up. And I've heard stories like this from other people.
Yeah, there's this idea that you know, Facebook is listening through your Instagram app on your phone or whatever else. I've seen other reports that say that, you know, Facebook is not listening, but when it's correlated with
a keyword?
Like
a keyword.
Typed. Yeah, I mean, there's theories that Facebook denies up and down that they're listening through the Facebook app and the Instagram app, which is owned by Facebook. But, you know, it's very easy once you start, you know, searching for stuff online to see ads on Facebook, elsewhere, right? This is how these companies make money, right? Facebook made literally tens of billions of dollars in revenue off of ads, right? So this is incredibly lucrative business.
But do you have any evidence that what you're saying is being listened to and then as a result you're getting coupons in the mail or something coming online?
I personally have not been fully convinced that that's the case. I think that people anecdotally have said, you know, this happened to me, but I think that there's a convincing reason to believe that either through our own behavior or through behavior of people that we know. So like if you had a conversation with somebody and then your friend on Facebook went and searched for mattresses or something, mm-hmm. like you could see how it wouldn't even need to have listening data. So I think there are many other ways that wouldn't necessarily require that.
And if you're paranoid about this, because listening to all this information, these articles, it kind of makes you sometimes a little paranoid,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You can go in on your phone and turn off all the microphones, but you have to do it for every single app. And I just realized that by default, my microphones were on.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's really hard to be, you know, vigilant about this kind of thing. It's really hard to know what settings to turn on and off, what to, you know. at the end of the day, you might say, well, I'm just going to go throw my phone in the ocean because I don't want to deal with this anymore.
Life might be. Well, you'd probably spend more time outdoors with your friends. Phil also wanted to talk about face recognition technology.
Yeah.
And you've got information in your book about face recognition technology. You write that it works a lot better in theory than it does in practice, but it is rapidly improving. While the idea of scanning someone's face to establish their identity has been floating around science fiction for years, it's now quietly becoming the norm. Last year, you reported that facial scanning pilot programs are already underway in international departure airports at 6 airports in the U.S., Boston, Chicago, Houston, Atlanta, New York City, and Washington, and more are set to expand next year. How do these work?
Well, so it works, you know, so a license plate scanner, license plate reader works by capturing an unknown plate. And right, so license plates are actually pretty easy to scan because license plates in every state have very certain and specific physical dimensions. So all license plates are roughly the same size. And they compare them against, you know, a list of known plates. Facial recognition is doing the same thing, except instead of scanning numbers and letters, it's scanning things like what is the distance between your pupils? How big is your nose? How big is your, you know, head at its widest point, at its tallest point? And guess what? The government already has, if you have a driver's license or a state ID or a passport, the government already has a really good picture of you that you have to submit if you want a passport or a driver's license or a state ID. So the problem with facial recognition is that, you know, like with the license plate readers, right, it's capturing an image in the wild against a known image and comparing those. It's a lot harder for facial recognition to capture images of somebody in the wild, right? They have to be looking at the camera with clear lighting straight on. So like a mugshot is really good for that. But if you're like the, you know, a Boston bombing suspect, for example, right? Facial recognition did not work in the Boston bombing case because, you know, if you're wearing sunglasses, if your head is turned, if you're wearing a hat, if you're wearing a hoodie, if you're, it turns out if you're African American, it is less likely to be able to successfully scan you. But again, these technologies continue to improve at a very rapid pace.
In a recent privacy assessment issued a month, actually, I'm not sure the timing on this one, the Department of Homeland Security noted that the only way for an individual to ensure that he or she is not subject to collection of biometric information when traveling internationally is to refrain from traveling.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
I mean
you just don't have a choice, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of these things where it's like you can choose to be totally private and live in a log cabin in the forest somewhere, and then you won't have a record of you, and you know you can just deal in, you know, cash or gold bars or Bitcoin or whatever you want, but then you relinquish the ability to participate in modern life, right? You can withdraw from the internet and not have Facebook and Instagram and stuff. The problem is that a lot of us like these services. A lot of us like, you know, sharing cat videos online with our friends.
Today we're joined by Cyrus Farivar, author of Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. Cyrus is a senior business editor at Ars Technica. And today we're talking about privacy, technology, and how these issues are covered, the importance of independent media so we can find out how we are being watched and also what's really happening in our own backyards. If you have any questions or comments, if something was found in your area, whether it's a drone or license plate readers, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You have so many interesting cases in your book. You write about the privacy of a variety of technologies that we all interact with every day, including email. What struck you the most when you were doing research? I mean, was there something that really surprised you or you didn't know about before?
Yeah, well, when I went down the license plate reader rabbit hole, for instance, and I tried to understand, well, what is the legality of this, right? What authority gives the government the ability to collect this kind of information? I was very surprised to learn that in many instances, not just with license plate readers, in many instances, the actual case, the actual Supreme Court case that law enforcement draws upon is really, in my opinion, very far removed from the technological reality in which we find ourselves today, right? That case that if you ask police, why are you allowed to do this, The answer that they will often give you is an early 1980s case called U.S. versus Knotts, which involves some guys in Minnesota making meth. I like to think of them as the 70s Minnesota equivalent of Breaking Bad. And one of them is driving at one point from the Twin Cities to a place called Shell Lake, Wisconsin, about 100 miles outside. And the police, to track the movements of this guy, they put what's described as a beeper. This is a short-range FM transmitter. And this is like 1970s-era technology we're talking about, so pretty crude compared to what we have now. They put this on a chloroform drum that is being driven from one place to another, and they follow him. At one point, they lose the signal. They have to call in a helicopter. And the question that the Supreme Court ultimately has to wrestle with was, did this violate the Constitution? Was this a Fourth Amendment violation against unreasonable searches and seizures? We talked a moment ago about this reasonable expectation of privacy. In this case, Knotts, the Minnesota meth guys, the court ruled that no, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy when you are in public. And that makes sense if you think about it, right? We want the police to be able, again, to do their jobs and see us and write down, you know, people or cars or license plates or whatever it is. But I would say it's a totally different proposition when you're talking about one officer with a pair of eyes and one notepad versus a machine that can do it at 60 plates per second.
What would you say to people who, I mean, interacting with law enforcement can be a very different experience based on your gender and your race, right? And there was the case of this woman at Yale who was napping in a room, a public room at Yale. A white woman saw her, called the police, and I just watched the video yesterday. I mean, the one thing that's amazing about video is all of these things that have been happening for decades are now out in the public sphere for everybody to see. So there is a video of this black woman being asked by police to hand over her ID. And she said, I go to school here. She opened her door. She showed him her dorm, and he still wanted her ID. And he went over in the corner and he did a check. Right? I'm guessing to see if there was something in her background. So, I mean, I have no idea, but he did call it in. So what would you say to people who are now frightened and really angry about what we're dealing with and how they are affected by this technology?
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes back to, I think, finding out what are the norms in your community? What technology exists in your community? What are the policies that exist? Are there policies at all? In many instances, there are not, right? So if you are a student at Yale University or whatever university, you know, I would be curious to know, like, if you are a student and you see somebody who you think, you know, may or may not belong there, like, what is someone supposed to do, right? What are the police supposed to do? Are there things that they should ask? Are there things that they should not ask, right? We do this already with things like undocumented people, right? California is a sanctuary state. California law enforcement, under current state law, are not supposed to ask people's immigration status when they interact with police. Maybe that gets abused sometimes. Maybe they're not following what they're supposed to do. But we have a law that says California police don't ask about immigration status.
And there is a story that just broke on The Guardian called Black Activist Jailed for His Facebook Posts Speaks Out About Secret FBI Surveillance. Rakim Balogun spoke out against police brutality. Now he is believed to be the first prosecuted under a secretive U.S. effort to track so-called black identity extremists. He was startled awake by a large crash and officers screaming commands. He soon realized his nightmare was real. He and his 15-year-old son were forced outside of their Dallas home wearing only their underwear.
Wow. I would love to learn more about the details of that case.
Yeah.
But apparently,
according to The Guardian, he was arrested in part because of his Facebook posts criticizing police. Now, what's so interesting, you write about corporations that make it difficult for the government to find your information, like to track your phone calls. In the case of Facebook, if your posts are public, anyone can see those.
Sure. And not only that, I mean, right, so Facebook is, it's important to, although it feels to us like it's public, it feels to us like it's kind of out in the ether and in the common, you know, square, essentially. Facebook is a private company, right? Facebook can set its own rules, and they change them all the time, right? They're in the wake of the recent Cambridge Analytica stuff. They are changing, you know, how they deal with advertisers, amongst various other things. I would imagine one of the thing, and I don't know what, I've never heard of this guy, I don't know precisely what he wrote, but, you know, I would imagine that it's in Facebook's terms of service that if you make violent threats against anyone, against police, against your neighbor, against anybody, probably they won't you allow you to post that. They might delete it, and they might report you to authorities because, you know, that's not, again, I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it, right, making physical threats against somebody is not protected by the First Amendment. So, you know, I don't know precisely what words he was using or precisely what he did. But, you know, if somebody were to say, I am going to attack this police officer, I think, you know, that might be more understandable.
You have written about a couple of email clients, for example, that want to ensure privacy. The email client that Edward Snowden used mm-hmm. was one of them. Can you name any other companies that would be familiar to us who really try to protect their users' privacy?
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting because I think in the wake of Snowden, a number of large companies, Google, Microsoft, are really, I think, starting to think about privacy in a new way, right? A lot of us use Gmail. Some people might say, well, I don't trust Gmail. I don't think Google will stand up for my rights. And you don't have to use it. Lavabit is the company that you're talking about that Edward Snowden previously used. Lavabit is a company that had shut down but does still exist. They operate out of Dallas by one guy named Ladar Levison, who went to court for years and spent quite a lot of money on legal fees trying to defend his users' privacy. And I think he would definitely do that again in the future.
Cyrus Farivar is author of Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. Cyrus, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.